to say we've got several issues on the table today, and I'd like to handle the ones that I think will go quickest. I'd like to handle those first, and sometimes it's hard to tell if something's going to go quickly or not, so we're kind of guessing on that one. I also want to tell the audience that I'm going to have to duck out because I'm testifying in another committee this afternoon, so I'll step out for a little while and come back, and we'll do the rest of the hearing. So let's start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 348, and I'm sorry, let's not have that public hearing. Let's start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 353. And if Harlan Levy is here and can testify on that bill, that would be great. At least right now, we won't have a lot of debate among the committee, I can guarantee you. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Ringo. Absent members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, Senior Staff Attorney with the Oregon Association of Realtors. Senate Bill 353 is a bill that we had requested, and we do appreciate this committee introducing it as a committee bill. What it does is it amends the disclosure statement, which is required in all real property sale agreements and earnest money receipts. It adds language that advises the parties about the potential effects of ballot Measure 37. Measure 37, like other aspects of Oregon's land use law, is unique to Oregon. And since 1983, the legislature has recognized the potential for some misunderstanding, hard feelings, and even monetary damages that exist when Oregonians undertake to buy or sell real property. And as a result, since 1983, the Oregon legislature has required that a warning statement be contained in earnest money agreements. That statement has changed over the years. It started out very simply as, and I quote, "This instrument does not guarantee that any particular use may be made of the property described in this instrument. A buyer should check with the appropriate city or county planning department to verify approved uses." That was the statement in 1983. Over the years, the legislature has looked at this four times and added various language over the years. So now we have language in there that advises buyers and sellers about Oregon's historic protection statutes. It advises buyers and sellers about our farm use zones, about fire protection, about Oregon Revised Statute 30.930 that regards farm protection statutes that limits lawsuits that landowners can bring against farmers to enjoin farm practices. And we think that with the passage of Measure 37, there ought to be some language in there that references this unique statute that we have in Oregon today. We believe that fair notice to property owners is a good thing. Buyers and sellers should be advised of their rights with respect to the property they are buying and selling. Realtors are responsible to disclose various things to their clients, and we think that it is a good thing for the legislature to put this information into all earnest money sale agreements so that all parties are apprised of their rights. With that, I will conclude my testimony and respectfully ask that you approve Senate Bill 353 and at some point move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Is this language intended to notify a potential buyer about the potential use of the land that they're looking at purchasing, or the potential use of perhaps the neighboring land?
Chair Ringo, it's both. It's designed to advise buyers that this measure exists, that this new statute that the voters passed exists, and that they ought to probably look into it. Realtors are not attorneys, and they're not qualified to give advice, legal advice, as it pertains to specific tracts of real property. They are required to spot issues, though, and one of the issues that they are now going to be responsible for is the existence of 137.
Can you give me just a hypothetical of how somebody might have wanted to know that there might be a piece of property might be impacted by Measure 37, and just give me a hypothetical how this might put them on notice of that?
Chair Ringo, if someone were to desire a rural residential home and ask that, you know, there not be any businesses close by because they've got children or some other reason, and they want to ensure that there's not going to be any commercial uses within a certain vicinity, they, you know, would need to go to their planning department and find out, you know, are there any potential for Measure 37 claims in the vicinity where adjacent landowners or neighboring property owners might wish to file claims, and then that would put the onus on the jurisdiction to either compensate for that claim or waive the regulation and allow for that use.
Okay, thank you. Committee, are there any questions?
I don't have any.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Kerry McLaren.
Good afternoon, Senator Chair Ringo, members of the committee. My name is Kerry McLaren, staff attorney with 1000 Friends of Oregon. I spoke briefly before this hearing with Harlan to let him know that I had just seen the bill and that I did have a couple of concepts. Would very much like this committee to know that in concept and for the reasons given in Harlan's hypothetical, we understand that new purchasers of property would want to know potentially what the uses are around them, and that Measure 37 upsets what had been the prior balance of being able to actually go and just look at the zoning map to be able to discern, oh, I'm in a rural residential zone, I can reasonably account that I'm just going to, or reasonably anticipate that I'm just going to have rural residential uses surrounding me, or some process by which I might get to participate in decisions to rezone or otherwise redesignate that. Measure 37, of course, disrupts that normal process and does allow landowners to have uses which might be considered conflicting uses with surrounding properties. So we do support the principle for which the realtors have put this bill forward. There are a couple of technical problems that I would encourage the committee to review and look at, specifically the way in which the first portion of the notice is now written, beginning on line 21, is unclear as to whether or not it is advising or inferring to new property owners that they themselves might have a Measure 37 claim, which of course isn't the case, because upon transfer of title you only have a potential for a Measure 37 claim for regulations enacted after you purchase the property. So I think that there is some clarifying that needs to be done with respect to this notice to really be appropriately or correctly characterizing what the impact is of Measure 37.
In other words, you don't think there can be an issue where a new purchaser would have a Measure 37 claim because they're the new purchaser?
As I read Section 8 of Measure 37, Chair Ringo, it appears as though the ability to waive, modify, or remove a land use regulation, to not apply, remove, or a land use regulation, which people are commonly referring to as waiver, or even the compensation claim, are both tied in Section 4, are both tied to land use regulations enacted prior to the date of acquisition, either by the owner or the family member. And so I think that this needs to be clarified to make it clear to, one, I mean, I think there are two objectives seeking here. One, to perhaps advise a new landowner that if new land use regulations are enacted after the date that he or she acquires the property, they might be eligible for a Measure 37 claim. But also, secondly, to advise that purchaser that neighboring landowners who have owned their property before the advent of some particular land use regulation may also have a Measure 37 claim, and should they seek such a claim, the outcome of that may have some impact on their property value. I think that's the overall, as I read it, at least intent.
Okay.
And I don't think the language quite gets there.
Okay. Go ahead.
That is essentially my comments for the committee. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay.
It's a little difficult to provide amendments orally, so I apologize for not having them in writing at this time.
Okay. Thank you. Committee, are there any questions?
Mr. Chair, no, I guess I was waiting for the suggested language, and but you just said you weren't going to give suggested language.
Chair Ringo, Senator Beyer, I can read to you the notes that I have written. What I proposed to Mr. Levy was I have a couple of real estate lawyers that I work with that I was passing my language by to make sure it passed muster with people who are generally engaged in real estate practice. But if I was to read for the committee, I would recommend starting on line 21 of line 22 after the word owner to insert of property including neighboring property, and then it would continue who believes A, and then insert the word new land use regulation or regulation, and then insert enacted after the owner parenthetical or a family member end paren has acquired the property, the word has, and then insert new, newly restricted the use of that property in a way that has, and continue on with devalued the owner's property to assert a claim for compensation, and it would continue on.
You follow up?
No, it's on the tape now, at least.
Okay.
Chair Ringo, Senator Beyer, thank you for recognizing. I was reading it more for that purpose, as I couldn't have written it down that quickly either.
Could we get Harlan back up to comment on that?
Yes, I think that's appropriate. Any other questions from this committee, or shall we? Harlan, why don't you come on up and give the response?
Thank you, Chair Ringo. I was trying to write it as you were talking, and I didn't get it all in. We're not opposed to fixing the language so that it is as accurate as possible. If it's the committee's feeling that it's not accurate enough now, there's time to get an amendment drafted to put in better language. We're not married to this particular language, I should say.
Okay.
We're happy to work with whoever this committee would like us to work with to get accurate language so that the earnest money agreement is as accurate as possible to buyers and sellers.
Thank you. And I was searching for Director Shetterly in the back of the room somewhere, and I hadn't noticed he snuck up
sitting
to the front.
In front of you, yeah.
So, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Harlan, are you an attorney?
Chair Ringo, Senator Barr, yes, I am.
Okay, so my concern is this, and this seems pretty clear to me to read. I'm not an attorney. We now have three attorneys in front of us, and this language that we're trying to draft is for non-attorneys. It's for people who probably aren't going to be attorneys who are trying to look at an earnest money agreement and know what it means without having to go get an attorney to see what it says. So I guess that would be my caution to those people that would draft this, is to remember that this is not intended for attorneys to read, but intended for non-attorneys to read, and it has to be clear so that the rest of us can know what it is we're signing.
Thank you, Senator Beyer. I agree with that, except the thing you don't understand is even attorneys don't understand this.
Chair.
Yes.
I think, and I, along the same lines, I would like, particularly in the case of farmland, where you have some farmland being sold where the adjoining property may qualify for a waiver that will be in conflict with farming practices. And, I would like to see a little bit more specificity about what we're talking about, either conflict with farming practices, or it could be land that does not have to comply, that may not have to comply with existing zoning requirements, or something to signal people that, more specifically, that they could basically have a 7-Eleven next to them before too long.
Thank you. Director Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lane Shetterly, actually appearing in this capacity as the governor's coordinator on Measure 37 for state. And Senator Beyer, in response to your question, I think the answer is that we've already lost those people in the language that already is in the notice. There's a lot of legalism in this. I think the idea here is making sure that we're accurate for whoever reads this and parses it. And I think I have the concern that I heard Ms. McLaren testify that this at least suggests, if somebody reads this, that they may be acquiring property with the potential for making a compensation claim. I think that assumes an interpretation of the measure that is contrary at this point to the advice we've received from the Department of Justice on the ability, the transferability. At the very least, it's not clear, and I think I would be cautious about putting language in this notice at this point until we have some further clarification as to that issue. My recommended just one set of amendments that you could think of that may be a little more straightforward than what I heard from Carrie would be to just begin on line 29 with the last word "the" and delete that phrase "the potential for making compensation claims," and then on the second page
I appreciate this. I'm sure you're right, but frankly, I think if you tell Harlan this there, because we're going to need to come back.
Okay, that's fine.
I think the three of you and anybody else can get together, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Is that all right?
No, you bet.
I'm happy
to do it.
Committee, anything else from the committee?
Outside.
Okay. Harlan, we'll let this sit for a while and improve with age.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll be back in front of you soon.
Okay. Thank you to all three of you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 353, and I'd like to open a work session on the introduction of committee bills. Again, this introduction is just as a courtesy to get the bills introduced. It doesn't indicate either support or opposition for the bills. Could the committee administrator just give us a summary of the bills?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have two LC drafts here, both of which relate to the Land Use Board of Appeals. Quickly, the LC 265 converts the Land Use Board of Appeals into a Land Use Court of Appeals and would place that court under the within the judicial branch. And LC 1449, which clarifies exceptions to the exclusive jurisdiction of Land Use Board of Appeals for land use review decisions.
Okay. I would like a motion to introduce LC 265 and LC 1449 as committee bills. Senator Atkinson?
Mr. Chair, I would move that we introduce LC draft 265 and LC draft 1449 as committee bills.
Thank you very much. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And let's open a public hearing on Senate Bills 348 and 349. Is Dave Honeycutt here, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregon Indian Action, speaking in support of both 348 and 349. I also, there's Chair Ringo, Joe Willis from Schwabe, Woods, and Wyatt, who's working with Mrs. English, is also in the room and assigned up to testify.
Well, if you'd like to come up and testify, that'd be fine right now, Mr. Willis. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. You've seen Senate Bills 348 and 349, at least, everybody on the committee, the two were all here last session. These are variations of House Bill 3631, which was approved on both sides of, in both the House and the Senate last session, subsequently vetoed by the governor. These, as you well know, are the Dorothy English, better known as the Dorothy English bills. The idea behind these being that we will go ahead if these bills are approved. I think Mrs. English would qualify under these bills and be able to take the 20 acres that she has in Multnomah County and divide that property into either 7 or 8 parcels, depending on which bill the committee adopts. You've probably, if you ever turned the radio on, in October and November heard the radio spots featuring Mrs. English. She is known around the state as the poster child for ballot measure 37. I can give, if the chair is interested, I can give a bit of history about the property. If not, just suffice it to say that she has owned her property for over 50 years. Her property is is 3/4 of a mile from the Portland city limits. It's in a commercial forest zone, and there's an elk habitat corridor overlay zone on the particular piece of property. It's our opinion, in any event, that the property is miszoned. And when Mrs. English bought the property, she and her husband, they originally bought 40 acres, sold 20 acres over the course of the years, the 50 years that they've had it, no longer can do anything with the property. And it was their desire when they purchased the property that they would use that property as an investment to fund their retirement. And obviously, as a result of the changes in the law, they no longer can. So we would hope that the committee would look favorably on these bills, and we certainly will do whatever we can to make sure that they pass.
Thank you. Now, one bill is 7 parcels. One is 8 parcels. I can just tell everybody that was a drafting glitch. Probably got 2 bills going, but. If not for the regulations subsequently imposed upon her, she would be able to subdivide into 8 parcels.
Chair Ringo, yeah, absolutely. She could, without the regulations that were imposed, she would be able to do far more than that.
Well, where does the number 8 parcels come from? Why 8?
Well, Senator Ringo and members, Joe Willis for the Shelby firm, I filed a Measure 37 claim for Mrs. English, and the reason she did that is that, one, I think she was being very reasonable, and two, she wanted to do what she could to match what was going on around her. If you drive up in that neighborhood and look, you see numerous McMansions out there enjoying these fabulous vistas. Her 20 acres by current regulations are prohibited from being further used for that purpose, and so we were just trying to do something with hopefully being very reasonable.
I see.
So,
okay. Yes, go ahead.
During the campaign, Mrs. English really was the poster child for Measure 37, and people responded to her plea for relief in her situation, and they passed Measure 37, which has made comprehensive changes to the statewide land use program that we still don't know what the impacts are going to be. My question to you is, if this measure passed for Mrs. English, why on earth do we need any bills to help her achieve her goals?
Well, let me respond, Senator Burdick and Senator Chair Ringo and the other members of the thing, is that I hope that you are aware of Multnomah County's response to her Measure 37 claim. The response was to pass what, in my opinion, is a intended, truly oppressive ordinance designed to prohibit and deter her and other persons that might have valid claims from making them. I don't know if you've seen that ordinance. If you've not, I would invite each of you to take a quick look through it. It imposes a $1,500 filing fee and the opportunity for the county to exceed that, impose a lien on her property for those funds. It purports to elevate that lien to the highest of all liens over other worthy liens, which I include in their eyes would have been a pre-existing mortgage. But it is a fantastically oppressive ordinance, and that was their response. Now, since then, I want to honestly tell you that because I've told them that they may well wind up with other litigation over that oppressive conduct, they had decided to at least informally speak with me about this. But they wanted everything done under their ordinance. It was mandatory. They purported to claim that her 180-day period wouldn't even begin to run until they told her claim was complete. All of those things are absolutely contrary to Measure 37. And Multnomah County has not been the only governmental institution in this state that's followed that lead. There have been several others. It's been very disappointing. And she is 92 years old. So I'm sorry.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think part of the problem is we really don't know what complies with Measure 37 or what doesn't at this point, because it hasn't been tested, and it it's not clear what it does or doesn't do, and I think that's probably why we're spending so much time on it in this committee. But it would seem to me that if you've got a problem with the ordinance, then you've got a problem with the ordinance. And to go around and find property owners and try to give them case-by-case exemptions from an ordinance that a county does not seem the appropriate way to do this.
Okay. I just call up a question on my own. Mr. Willis, a lot of smart people have read the words of Measure 37 and concluded that it does not give one the right to subdivide. And I'm not asking you what to agree or disagree with that, but I guess your opinion. But isn't it true that is a question on the table? That there's going to be, if we don't do anything with Measure 37, that will be subject to litigation?
I am pretty sure Multnomah County wants to do that because their ordinance flatly says it's not. My opinion is clearly that it does, and I invite your attention to the language in Measure 37, which describes defines land use regulations to include those types of land division ordinances. Now, and to Senator Burdick about the clarity of this, and I sincerely believe this, I don't think anyone can read that language and come up with the conclusion that Multnomah County has and embedded in their ordinance.
Well, Mr. Willis, I'm not here to beat you up or Measure 37 or Multnomah County. I'm just trying to understand some of the legal uncertainty surrounding Measure 37, and not just Multnomah County, but Lawyers for the Bankers Association, for example, which they're not Multnomah County, they're just bankers trying to figure out how to lend money, have expressed uncertainty with respect to the transferability of Measure 37 rights.
And I appreciate that.
You know that they have expressed uncertainty in that regard.
I don't know that for a fact, but I predicted they would as soon as they read Multnomah County's ordinance, because no one in their right mind will lend on those things, and as long as those ordinances like that are on the books and to continue, they're going to have their way and frustrate what I think was the purpose of Measure 37.
All right, well, not just in Multnomah County, but from all over the state.
Yeah. I mean, I know Bend has done. No, Bend didn't do that. I'm sorry, but I've seen several of these efforts at a very, very difficult ordinance.
Okay. So. I guess maybe to Mr. Honeycutt, do you think that these bills are, in light of these uncertainties, are reasonable things to do to help Ms. English?
Well, Chair Ringo, I think the most significant aspect of these two particular bills, you've got to take into account that Mrs. English is 92 years old, and unfortunately, in this country, whether it's here or in any other state, if a dispute arises and parties can't resolve their disputes, then we resort to the judiciary to solve disputes. Measure 37 contains a provision that allows a person to resort to the judiciary if they can't resolve their dispute, and as you well know, as practicing attorney, Mr. Chair, you've got a decision made locally in the trial court, conceivably under Measure 37, with a subsequent appeal to the Court of Appeals and possibly an appeal to the Oregon Supreme Court from there. That process, by the time that process is completed, and again, I don't know any other way to do that and be consistent with the way that we litigate or that we resolve all disputes in this country, but that being the case, by the time we're done litigating this, Mrs. English, she doesn't have a whole lot of time to wait.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Could I have Derek Tokos of Multnomah County and Stephen Kafori come up, please? Somebody who stood up is not Stephen Kafori.
I think he just left.
Okay. Well, come on up.
He's back.
We'll get to him in a second. Go ahead.
Chair Ringo, members of the committee, I'm Mike MacArthur. I'm the executive director of the Association of Oregon Counties and here to comment on the bills that you are considering here today. The association is certainly sympathetic to some of the hardships and inflexibility that our land use system imposes. However, you hear us talking in the building quite a bit about systems of governance that exist between the state and counties. What we have here is a land use system. And in that land use system, as we see it, the state defines the broad policies, sets the objectives, the county implements those objectives. We see these bills as a way of reaching down into local government and making specific decisions. We generally object to those types of actions by the legislature. That covers including special legislation that would supersede. We objected to that sort of legislation for public facilities. We think it's a slippery slope to begin to look at these individual exemptions. We think Measure 37 is there in place to address some of the grievances that that exist out there. That process is well defined in the measure that was passed by the voters. I think we need a chance to see how that works. We hope that you will recognize that this legislation like this may very well open the door to a number of other concerns like this that could come before the legislature and make your life a whole lot more difficult. So on behalf of the association, I'd ask you to think carefully about supporting this type of individual land use action.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Ringo, members of the committee. I'm Stephanie Soden, representing Multnomah County. Today with me, I have a principal planner, Derek Tokos, from Multnomah County, to outline our policy concerns with Senate Bill 348 and 349.
Okay. I just want to say for the record that I agree that supersiding is not good policy in general, that legislation designed for one person or just a few people is not good policy, but I like to think that we're not completely inflexible. That we do have the ability to look at special cases and do the right thing. For example, last session we passed a bill to allow a fireworks factory in Canby to continue to operate, even though it was non-complying use. And the reason we did that is because you step back, you look at that case, you don't want a fireworks factory in downtown Portland, you want it out in farm country. So I understand your policy concerns, I generally agree with them, but I think there is room for flexibility. So with that, go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Ringo, members of the committee, Derek Tokos, principal planner with Multnomah County. We prepared some testimony in a letter today that we've distributed. I'll not read through that testimony, but we'll touch on some of the key points in it. And we're here today to testify regarding both Senate Bills 348 and 349. As Mr. Honeycutt had mentioned, this legislation was introduced last legislative session. The county opposed it at that time. What I'd like to do is just kind of summarize some of the reasons why the county has some concerns with it again this session. First, as has been discussed, Multnomah County is currently evaluating a Measure 37 claim involving a property that would that this legislation is directed to. That claim and that evaluation is as yet unresolved. These bills would preempt the county from interpreting ballot measure 37 and circumvent the processes that that measure establishes to allow this landowner and perhaps a handful of others to immediately proceed to subdivide their land. It would be one thing if this legislation was directed at clarifying ambiguities in the measure, such as whether or not land divisions are something that can be authorized through a waiver and what the conveyability is of these development rights, but it's not. If it was looking at this more holistically, more would benefit. But this legislation is directed to advance the interests of a single citizen or perhaps a handful of citizens. Those interests are contrary to the existing land use rules that the county has, the existing land use rules that the state has. Now, part of the testimony that is in the letter that we provided was almost verbatim from the last session, and in that we kind of described kind of the circumstances that Multnomah County is in. Multnomah County has a vibrant rural economy, agricultural economy, rural communities. They're on the doorstep of the Portland Urban Growth Boundary, the largest metropolitan area in the state. There is constant tension in terms of resource type activities and urban development, and it is a difficult balance to achieve. And one way the county has approached that is over the last 10 years, the county's done numerous rural area plans with its citizens, both in every geographic area in the county, and they're all different. To try to work with them, get them engaged in the planning process, and develop plans that work for their interests, as well as meet state laws and other rules that we are obliged to meet. And this legislation is contrary to those plans that we work with our citizens on. And so those are our concerns at this point. If you have any questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there any other lands that would this bill or these bills would apply to?
Chair Ringo, Senator Barr, if I understand the question, are there other lands that this bill would apply to? Did I get that correctly?
Yes. Besides Dorothy English. Besides the Dorothy English property.
You know, there may be. The last legislative session, we had done some work on that, but I don't recall what the results were. We could certainly be happy to follow up with any information we can on that.
That would be great if we could do that. Anything else from the committee? Stephanie, do you have anything to add? Or?
No. Okay. Thank you very much. Wait a minute. I'm getting a note here.
Never mind.
Now it's a never mind. We're going to close the public hearing on these two bills. And we're going to open a public hearing on secondary lands, particularly as it impacts Measure 37, understanding of this issue. And I'd like, is Ron Ebert here? I don't see him. There he is in the back. And I apologize. I'm going to have to duck out for a minute. Senator Atkinson will be in charge.
You want to Ebert here? We shall go over there. Huh?
What?
We shall go over there and testify in order to kill photo red light, shouldn't we?
Mr. Ebert, please proceed.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ron Ebert with the Farm and Forest Land Specialist for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And on this discussion of secondary lands, the memo that you're getting simply lays out a history and how Oregon has approached that for approximately the last 20 years. And my apologies to Senator Burdick, who at the time was on the Land Conservation and Development Commission. This is probably deja vu all over again. This is simply intended to show you that this issue of marginal land, secondary land, small-scale resource lands has been dealt with extensively by the legislature, by the commission, and a variety of committees, county tests of mapping, and a variety of criteria. It's been proven difficult to successfully do this. The commission came up with a general definition and a process, which then by House Bill 3661, the legislature instructed the commission to repeal those rules and substituted a different process in 93 that combined lot of record and other ways to get dwellings within the existing zones. There were essentially the secondary lands issue was difficult to deal with for policy, technical, and jurisdictional issues, which made it difficult, both in terms of do you identify secondary lands and separate them as a block from primary lands as a policy matter, or do you allow those type of lands of lower quality or those that are impacted by existing development to be identified case by case within farm and forest zones. That was one aspect of the debate. The technical matter of then determining which lands are secondary and which are primary has proven difficult. I would suggest if you venture into this subject matter, it would be important to hear from the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Forestry with regard to these matters. And then finally, and I think you just heard part of the debate, the jurisdictional issue about who gets to set the standard. If the state or the legislature is setting a certain standard, who carries it out? What is the role of the counties in adopting additional standards, and who reviews the work of the local jurisdictions also proved to be a difficult exercise. The second part of the memo simply points out that Oregon has a wide range of provisions already that allow for development on lands of lesser quality. And without getting into all the details, simply to point out that involves differing standards for high-value and non-high-value farmland, the designation of marginal lands in Lane and Washington County, the exceptions process, which has identified over 890,000 acres that are already in developed rural residential categories, which is actually more land that is inside the urban growth boundaries in the state of Oregon. There are a lot of record dwelling and non-farm dwelling provisions that have enabled a great many dwellings to be approved, both based on prior ownership, which is a lot of record dwelling, and non-farm dwellings, which are sited on lands that are generally unsuitable for farm or forest use. Most of those are sited in eastern Oregon and southern Oregon. There is also a forest lot of record and template dwelling provision, which has also allowed over 2,700 dwellings since 1994 in forest zones. There are over 86,000 acres that have been identified as non-resource lands in the state as not being subject to goals 3 and 4. So the purpose of the memo is simply to point out Oregon has a process for identifying these lands different than doing it as a straight-up planning exercise, which is and can be difficult, contentious, expensive to do either in establishing the criteria at the state level or carrying out the actual planning at the local county level. If you have any questions, I'd be more than glad to answer specific questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. Is this a departure for the agency? I always thought from years of banging my head on the table over the phrase secondary lands that the department didn't recognize the phrase secondary lands.
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, no, we do recognize the phrase. As I pointed out, it's come in many forms. In fact, the commission in 1988 came up with a general definition at the direction of the legislature to define secondary lands, at least in general form, and in fact in 1992 developed the process for identifying, didn't call them secondary lands, call them small-scale resource lands that were the subject of being repealed in 93. So I think the planning system has recognized that there are lands of differing qualities around the state, and the existing planning system provides for ways for identifying and allowing more development on those than on the higher quality or the high value type lands.
Do you, Mr. Follow-up, do you think that that really works in rural Oregon? What are your last sentence? Allowing development on secondary lands instead of on high value farmland?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, yes, I do.
We have a difference of opinion because I don't think it does. I think that's one of the biggest hurdles we have in rural Oregon is watching the prime farmland getting paved while what we consider secondary lands untouched. That's, I think, part of the frustration in my district regarding Measure 37.
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, the numbers that we provide show that development is occurring. I think the issue would be different folks will have different views on how much development is appropriate on these different lands. You know, but the existing system has, as it's constructed, worked to allow more development on lower quality lands and to protect the higher quality lands and keep urban areas contained. There's obviously a great deal of disagreement on whether more or less of that should occur in specific locations, but as a general rule, it has worked in that form.
Okay, Mr. Chair, just as a comment, as a general rule, it doesn't work in Southern Oregon. If you look at the community of Central Point, if you look at the community of Grants Pass, if you look at the community even of Phoenix, Oregon, it doesn't work. One size doesn't fit all.
Just a question, Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson. One of the comments I hear often is that the decision should be made locally, not in Salem or not. What would make it work?
Well, I think you have to have a regional approach to it. I think that does make a lot of sense. What is considered marginal or what was a new non-resource land in the Lamp Valley is not the same as in Southern Oregon. Southern Oregon, for instance, some of the richest farm topsoil is in the community of Central Point. And if you go by the traditional planning model of the Lamp Valley and you just take the UBG out, Central Point sits in this little portion of the Rogue Valley. On one side you have an area of White City that is if you remember the shrimp issue that came up with the wetlands, and on the just outside of it you have what's considered non-high valuable forest land but would be considered secondary land. What Central Point has done is grown, which is what's happening in that town, which is great, but the very best farmland has been paved over while the other land sits untouched. So you, on one hand, we don't want to have this quilt approach to land development, but on the other hand, the system doesn't, it causes more frustration than it does workability. And I think that would be the same if you were to take that type of a thing to eastern Deschutes County. I think you could argue that also, maybe even in Union County. What's a secondary land where I live is not a secondary land where the capital is. It's just that simple.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer. And Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just, you know, if we're having a little bit of a debate here between ourselves, you don't have to go to Southern Oregon to see that. You don't have to go to Eastern Oregon.
You should come to Southern
Oregon. You don't have to go to Eastern Oregon to see that. You can sit in the city we are in right now and see the perfect example of what's happening. All the development in the Salem area is to the east and to the north. High-value farmland. There is no development allowed to the south and to the west, where farmers couldn't make a living on that ground if they tried to. They don't try to because it's such low-value farmland. But that's where the development happens in Salem, because that is where the people, the UGBs, have gone. That's where people want to develop, because it's easier to develop on flatland farmland. Same has happened in Canby. Some of the, probably the most productive soil in the world is in the Canby area. And the, it just, and they're paving that, the most productive land in the world over, because that's where the UGB had been drawn years ago. Same in Woodburn, same in Hillsboro, same in Beaver. You don't have to leave the Willamette Valley to see that the system that had been developed for 30 years is working exactly the opposite as it was designed to work.
Senator Burdick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just think from this discussion, I go back a long way with Mr. Ebert. I was chair of the Secondary Lands Subcommittee for Land Conservation and Development Department back in the late 80s and early 90s. And it's just, it's probably the most difficult issue we faced with the commission, because it gets into all the issues you've mentioned. The development pressure coincides with the best farmland. The situation in eastern Oregon is different than the situation in western Oregon. And one of my colleagues on the commission and I once actually thought we had an agreement to have a two-part standard for secondary land, whether it be east of the mountains or west of the mountains. And that looked like it was going to go for a while, and then it fell apart. And one of the problems that we have here is that one person's secondary land is another person's treasured farm or another person's treasured viewscape. And I'm not saying I approve of this, but if you look at some place like in Portland, in the Portland area, the Stafford Triangle, land that clearly should be within the urban growth boundary by any measure that makes sense. And because of political pressure, it is not productive farmland. It's vacant land, but it's not productive farmland. It's in prime development area. By any reasonable person's, you know, standards, that would be secondary land, because it's right where the development's going. It's not productive farmland, but political pressures have kept it from being brought into the urban growth boundary. So I'm not giving any solutions here. I will just tell you that this is probably the most frustrating, complicated issue that I've seen in the land use business. It's just no matter which side of the issue you're on.
Thank you, Senator Burdick.
And Madam Chair, just as a comment, I would agree with that.
Madam Chair?
Thank you.
Sorry, Senator.
The other committee.
Chair. I would agree with Senator Burdick, and that, you know, this has been worked on now for 20-plus years. And the reason is that as soon as you try to put that label on a land, you're goring someone's ox. Because a secondary land all of a sudden becomes more viable, it's developable. And that's what the inequities of Measure 37, in my opinion, were intended to fix. It goes back to what was the property's value when it was purchased by a person. And that's the intent of Measure 37. That's why, you know, because when you purchase something, it has value. And you pay for what you purchase. And if that value is taken away from you by changes after it purchased, that's what you should be compensated for. That's what you should be able to do. And to me, that's what got us to this issue, is because if you try to define a secondary land issue, you're goring somebody's ox. There's going to be political fights back and forth. Because you are creating winners and losers, versus something that's, you know, in my opinion, as simple as Measure 37, that what you could use your property for when you bought it, you can continue to use your property for, or be compensated for it. That makes sense.
Not sure it's that simple, but thanks for the comment.
It's one more approach, Senator Beyer.
Yes, Mr. Ebert.
Chair Ringo, one more comment in response to Senator Atkinson's concerns, and I understand those concerns about how urban growth boundaries grow. I would suggest that that is a connected but distinctly different and separate issue from what I was characterizing as the secondary lands issue. The secondary lands issue has traditionally been within areas designated for farm or forest use. How do you recognize secondary lands and allow more development on those and protect the higher quality lands? The issue of how urban growth boundaries expand in terms of population pressures and where the cities are and on which lands they select is a separate issue, and one that the commission and other legislation has talked about addressing, may address this session, or might be part of what the governor is suggesting is a larger review of the land use system. But it is separate from what I was discussing.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, but it's really not separate in my comments. I don't think this system works. And I don't think there's anybody, regardless of all the special interests that sprout up on this issue, regardless of all the reporters and all that, I don't think this is one side wants to pave all of Oregon and the other side wants to lock it up from anybody to walk on. I just don't believe that. I think every one of us that reflects, from us, Southern Oregon and rural, all the way to urban legislators, want to make sure we have a pretty state. But this system is doing the exact opposite of what it was sold to this body with Senate Bill 100 in many parts of the state. And we can, you know, go around the fringes all the time, but you got to remember the fact that Oregonians are upset. And they're not upset because it's working real well. They're upset because it's not working real well. Two constituents came to me today, who are running up huge lawyer bills just trying to get to the answer of how to negotiate between a city and a county and LCDC. Because everybody, all three of those, are say, bring me another rock, run up an attorney bill. Just to do something that doesn't make, it's just not clear. And I don't like telling constituents, I pride myself in our constituent work, but I don't like saying, go hire an attorney, because, I don't know, I'll bring in the city, and I'll bring in the county, and I'll bring in LCDC. And I'm not going to be able to wade through all this because I'll get back to you later. Bring me another rock. I think all of Oregon is frustrated. I'm frustrated. This whole thing is secondary lands. Just gets under my skin because I live in an area that many people could argue is secondary lands. It don't work. It's not doing what it's supposed to do. It's not giving all the Oregon that we all protected, said we're running for to create. So that's my frustration. I appreciate your comments, but you know, I've been here long enough. You know, I know almost everyone out there's neckties. I know how all you dress. I've seen the people who are here to testify before, and we beat this around. And you know what? Nothing happens. And then Measure 37 comes, and then we're going to try to undo that. People are frustrated. I represent those people. I'm frustrated.
Calm down, Senator Atkinson.
You want me to come to committee? You're going to get me the way I am. Frustrated.
Thank you, Mr. Ebert. A comment to the committee, including Senator Atkinson, and to the audience. The reason that I wanted to put this on the agenda is because I am convinced that this is one of the points of discontent in the Oregon land use system that we need to fix. And I don't know that people are trying to undermine Measure 37. I think it's not clear that Measure 37 solved the problems that were giving rise to the discontent, and I would appreciate the help of everybody on this committee and everybody in the audience in how to make significant strides in addressing that in exactly the kind of way you were talking about. So that's why I wanted to have this hearing.
Calm down, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Ebert. And I it's my hope that we can discuss specifics instead of just does it work, doesn't it work, but what we ought to do. And I think we're going to hear from Dave Honeycutt next and hear his suggestion. But go ahead. Last word, Mr. Ebert.
I would just say, Mr. Chair, if the committee decides to wade into this subject matter, we stand ready to assist. We've been at it for a long time, and wherever it goes, it goes.
Thank you very much. Dave Honeycutt and Ross, do you want to come up? No? Okay. Yeah, who? Oh, Joe Willis.
No, we've got Dwayne Weeks here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregon Indian Action. I've got a whole series of handouts that I'd like to present to the committee because I think it gives you some background about what it is that specifically that we're talking about. And if it's okay, Matt, I'll bring them up. I'll start out with the LCDC's definitions of agricultural land in Goal 3 and forest land in Goal 4. You need to walk through those definitions. I think it'll give you an idea about how broadly the state has defined both agricultural land and forest land, which leads to the, given the breadth of the definition, leads you to the inescapable conclusion that most land outside of urban growth boundaries is going to be zoned for farm or forest use, regardless of whether it's capable of being used for farm or forest purposes. That in fact is true. 97% of the privately owned land outside of urban growth boundaries is in farm forest zones.
Dave, I'm happy to spend some time stepping through this, but I'm just wondering whether you're going to get to a suggestion and proposal.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
But before we get there, Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me for a little bit,
we will.
It's important that the committee understand where the definition of agricultural land and forest land is coming from, and it's coming from the definitions found in Goals 3 and 4. Goal 3, the Commission's Ag Land Goal, defines ag land in Western Oregon as 1 through 4 soils, and in Eastern Oregon as 1 through 6 soils. There are 8 different types of soil classifications, and so in Eastern Oregon you've got 1 through 6, 1 being the best and 8 being rock, but it goes beyond 1 through 6. If you're in 1 through 6 in Eastern Oregon, you're automatically, your property is automatically deemed agricultural land, but then you go on to include other lands, and again in Eastern Oregon you'd just be talking about 7s and 8s, which is mostly rock and all rock. And of course, those 7s and 8s can also be included in the definition of ag land if they're suitable for farm use, taking into consideration soil fertility, suitability for grazing, climatic conditions, existing and future availability of water for farm irrigation purposes, existing land use patterns, technological and energy inputs required, or accepted farming practices, or if they're necessary to permit farm practices to be undertaken on adjacent or nearby lands. They're included as agricultural land, even if they're class 7s and 8 soils. Now, in order to give you a little understanding of the differences between class 1 and class 8 soil, we've taken language out of a USDA, a Soil Conservation Service publication, much like this one. This is the soils map for Union County. We've taken the definition, and it defines at the bottom of the page here what the limitations are for each of the different soil classifications, so it gives you an idea of what we're talking about. You need to understand that once you get over onto the east side and you look into some of the class 5 and 6 soils, you're really talking about things that if we were out there standing on it, we'd call sagebrush and lava rock, the kind of land where your cows have to run at 40 miles an hour to find something to eat. And I just to give you an example, I looked or I copied from the soil survey of the Upper Deschutes River area, which is part of Klamath County, part of Jefferson County, part of Deschutes County, the land capability classes and the yields per acre of crops and pasture for the various different types of soil classes, and I'll hand that out as well. And what you'll see, uh, is that you get into this area, and because of the elevation, because of the lack of precipitation, because of the lack of water rights on most of these parcels, they're not irrigated. They have absolutely no capability of crop production or pasture or mint or grass seed or potatoes or whatever you have. They're really not used for anything. And of course, our founding fathers and mothers realized that as well, because if you go out there, you'll see that they're, again, sagebrush and lava. The same holds true for Union County. I took, again, the soil survey from Union County. I went through and counted all of their class 5 and 6 soils, which in eastern Oregon is automatically fits within the definition of agricultural land. Counted all of their 5 and 6 soils. There are 20 different types of 5 and 6 soils in Union County. One out of those 20 has the ability to produce a modest amount of pasture, and 8 out of the 20 have the ability to produce a modest amount of grazing capability. The other 12 don't. 8 out of the 20 also have the ability to produce with very severe limitations soils capable of producing trees, although they're I think predominantly juniper, and the remaining soils don't. So it, just taking Union County for example, of the 20 different class 5 and 6 soil types in Union County, 12 out of those 20 have no capability to do anything, and yet under LCDC's definition of agricultural land, they're zoned for agricultural land. And so it's those types of issues where you get people that own land, and particularly over on the east side and in southern Oregon in Senator Atkins' area, where land that nobody has ever farmed, it can't be farmed, it won't be farmed, there are no water rights, that's zoned for farm and forest use, that I think drive a lot of the frustration behind the system. What we would suggest, Chair Ringo, is that you take a look at that the legislature itself take a look at defining agricultural land, either that or you direct the commission to do so in a way that would leave the valley, the existing definition in Western Oregon for the valley alone. Instead of having Western Oregon and Eastern Oregon, you would have the Willamette Valley and everywhere else. You would leave the valley alone. You could use the existing definition of ag land in Goal 3 for the Willamette Valley. Outside of the valley, you would adopt the definition of high-value farmland in ORS, I think it's 215.705 or 710. Essentially, what we're talking about outside the valley is Class 1 and 2 soils. Those are going to be irrigated lands and irrigated lands that are growing specified perennials. So we'd be getting into the orchards in Hood River County, some of the orchard land in Jackson County, some of the cropland in Jefferson County. But beyond that, what we would suggest is that rather than leaving those, rather than trying to define uses on that land that doesn't fall within the definition of ag or forest land, you would simply say that those are matters of local concern. You would give the local governments the ability at that point to decide what they wanted to do on those lands that don't fall within the definition of agricultural land or forest land, and you would allow them then to make up their own minds. Now, you know, you get out there and you get out of Bend and you start on your way to Burns, and you get about halfway out there. It doesn't matter whether you call it secondary lands or not. It's going to look the same 10 years from now as it does today. Nothing's going to happen. And for the most part, there's a lot of land out there that's going to look like that. But it's our position that once you get beyond the things that we're really talking about protecting, the Willamette Valley and that some of that cropland in Hood River County and some down in Jackson County and over into Jefferson County, then the rest at that point ought to be a matter of local concern, and you let the local governments decide, consistent with all of the other 19, or I guess in that case the other 18 land use goals. So that would be our suggestion. As far as the definition of forest land goes in Goal 4, what we would suggest there is that you simply delete the last section, the very last part of the definition of forest land, other forested lands that maintain soil, air, water, and fish and wildlife resources, and you limit the definition of forest land to land that's suitable for commercial forest use and adjacent or nearby lands that are necessary to allow those.
Excuse me, I need to step out, but Senator Atkinson will continue.
With that, Mr. Chair, I will conclude and then turn it over to Mr. Weeks.
Just a moment, Senator Ryan.
Thank you, Dave. Where did you on your Goal 4 forest land? Could you point to where that is?
Yeah, the definition of forest land in Goal 4 is the second paragraph. It starts out with forest lands. Are those lands acknowledged as forest lands? What I would suggest is that you delete, beginning with the word or on the third line from the bottom, or practices, or excuse me, the word and other forested lands that maintain soil, air, water, and fish and wildlife resources.
Thank you.
So what we're really talking about when we're talking about forest land is commercial forest land and any adjacent or nearby lands that are needed to allow commercial forest activities to occur. I think that's more consistent with the economic model that for forest land that was the at least as I believe the intent envisioned with Senate Bill 100.
Go ahead.
Senator Askew, Vice Chairman of the Committee. I'm Dwayne Weeks, live in Canby.
Thank you.
I've been vitally interested in this particular sphere of things that's been happening the last 30 years because I live right in the middle of the goldfish bowl and have had a wealth of background experience leading up to it, so I think I have a pretty good understanding of it. I was a county agent for 13 years in the state of Washington. I have a couple of degrees from Washington State University in agricultural fields. I've been a real estate appraiser for about 20 years, appraising farmland all up and down the valley. Well, I have a pretty good understanding of it, and I've had my own farm for 38 years. I've also managed a large corporate berry farm for several years, 350 acres, and worked on a lot of these types of lands. I've done experimental and test work in cooperation with experiment stations when I was an agent. So I'm just at a loss what to come out. And I got so much information that I don't know quite where to start, except when it comes to all of the start with this land class, well, 1 through 8 that Dave talked about. As a county agent and subsequent work in agriculture, we always maintain that there of the classes, land classes 1 through 8, the land class 1 is the best land and might comprise 2 to 3% of the land that's farmable. Land class 2 is still a very good land that can provide the family a good living on an economic unit without having to do extra work such as irrigation. But when you drop down to land class 3, you're into average type soils, and you either have to have good management or supplemental skills like irrigation or et cetera to make a decent living on it. When you get to land class 4, you're down into marginal land, but you have to have above average management to be able to supply for your family if you have an economic unit. You get down to 5 and 6, I'm sorry, you're not going to make a living on it. And I'm talking mainly of crop and pasture type land, or crop land, because the land productivity is not that great. There's too many deficiencies in the soil to prevent it from being highly productive. Could be slope, could be rock inclusion, could be wetland or too wet in certain times of the year that it wouldn't take certain crops. And then when you get to 7 and 8, they're either hillside or sloughs. And that's basically the way in working out with people. That's about the uses that they put this 1 through 8 land. I have sat through many of the committees at the instigation of LCDC. I disagreed with it. I participated in some of the surveys that they gave out in 1973. I disagreed with it. Those are all stories that I could go on for a long time about, but I'm not going to unless you ask me. The thing that bothers, there's two things, two real general things that I see that enter into this. One is the definition of prime farmland. They've read the land class 1 through 8. This also is the book for Clackamas County Soils Conservation Service. The exact wording in Union County is used in this book. Here's a book for Marion County. The same wording is used as in his Union County book, in the Clackamas book, Marion County. Somewhere in those books, you'll find the definition of land classification. And they're all saying the same exact words. And the Soil Conservation Service has been surveying, they call them surveys, mapping soils throughout the United States for, I'm not sure the exact date that it started, but I know I have a 1927 Clackamas County map, and I have a 1928 Marion County map. And these are dated, this one's dated 72, this one's dated 84. So about every 50 years they come around and update the maps. They don't change the terminology. Soil terminology is the same. But, I went to school 50, 60 years ago, and Scherner's and soil then is Scherner's and soil now, or Podzolic, or Podonic, or whatever. They have a basic scientific name that they carry on through. The name that we talk on soils, like Willamette silt loam, that's because the first time it was mapped was in the Willamette Valley. Or you take up other places. They pick the first time the soil surveyors find it, they put a name on it, and then that hangs with it. Then you might find it in quite a few different counties, but they still come to the first time it was run across. Prime farmland, in our mind, until LCDC came along, was generally the land that you could produce a good living on without having to augment it or prop it up to make a good living. It usually included, like I said before, 3 to 5% of the agricultural land available. The other thing that, on the secondary land issue that I hit in quite a few different times, most recently in surveying or in appraising, was the land was stopped. Let me put it back up and put it another way. I noticed that to have someone want to develop a rural resident, they had to have a septic permit, septic feasibility permit, to build a house on it. As you go through, that says that you have to have your soil has to percolate and take care of it. As you go through the soils, there's very few of them, and where do you find them? Centered wire, you find them around Canby, you find them in places, and the percolation has to percolate 6 feet. If there's any question in the county's soil engineers that okay a site for a house, they make you dig a hole 2 or 3 feet deep, 2 or 3 feet wide and 6 feet deep, and that's got to go through a winter, and they won't issue the permit till next March 15th. They got to see if there's standing water. If the water doesn't stand, then you stand a chance of getting your permit. If it does stand, it's out. And there's only just very, very, very few soils that will exist in. And then, so that makes it pretty tough to build. And this kicks out all the land. I'm going to speak now between Canby and Oregon City and Malala. I'm home, Senator Meyer. There's thousands of acres out there. There hasn't been a house put out there for 20 years, hardly. There's been a few. I don't know whether that helped or not, but there's been a few, but they've been pretty good sized houses. And that land is, an old lady told me one time, you couldn't raise a fuss on it. So it's not agricultural land. What use is it? It sits there, and if a house was approved in the last few years, they haven't even approved them on down around Canby and in the deep soil where you go 80 feet before you hit a restrictive layer. They haven't, but if you put a house on that, you ask for a house, you're not going to get it. Now, in Canby, there has been, up until the last couple of years, several engineering firms that made sewage treatment plants. I understand there's 46 states in the union that look at and accept sewage treatment plants. Oregon is one of them that does not. I've heard why, but it isn't authentic. But you can take some of this odd-shaped land with a little bit of rocks in it, land that isn't good farmland, and put a pod of 25 to 100 houses on there with a sewage treatment plant. You're giving a rural air to it. You're putting some land to use that otherwise would lay there totally fallow and not used. If this body could somehow get in there and approve a sewage treatment plant law and have it have some teeth in it, keep it from contaminating any streams or anything else. It takes some engineering, but everything else nowadays takes engineering too. I think those two things could go a long ways, and this would carry on over into the eastern part that you're talking about too. If you could cluster residences where a treatment plant would do it instead of trying to gerrymander a septic tank. Now, there has been quite a bit of work done in the last 20 years on engineering and septic tanks, and there's some names in the trade that are acceptable, and a few houses have been built with them, but they are quite expensive. There's a cap and fill, and the old sand filter or kitty litter box.
Mr. Weeks, could you summarize where you're? Those are two great suggestions. Can you start to conclude where your opinions on the secondary lands and
On the secondary lands? What do you want to hear?
Well, I think you've given. Maybe I'll open up for questions. Is that okay?
Sure.
Is there any questions?
I'm actually fascinated by what you're saying. I kind of just wonder, how do we get from here to there, you know, in a logical, sequential way? We don't want to do away with all the land use planning we've ever had, but how do we make it more logical? I mean, taking a piece of land that's not useful for anything else, and like you were talking about, putting a pod of 25 houses on it with its own little sewage treatment plant, that's logical, you know.
Senator Shields, there's three of them in existence. As this debate came up in 1968, 69, 70, 71, long in there, Representative Alan Penn from West Linn, at the time he sat here in the legislature, he developed Century Meadows about 2 or 3 miles west of Canby, just barely over into the Marion County line, But he put in a pod there of about 100 mobile homes with a sewage treatment plant, and it was understood it was kind of a test case to see if it worked. 30 years later, still working good, and there's 100 homes there.
And what kind of soils was under it?
It was useless land because it had a little bit of a roll to it, but it was nearer a bluff that you couldn't get in too irregular to get in to farm it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was about a mile west of the Aurora Airport, there's another one, Deer Creek Estates. Quite a bit of swale in there. You couldn't farm through it, but there's about 100 mobile homes in that one. It's about 2 miles from Century Meadows. About 3 miles south of that, there's another pod of, these are all stick-built houses, right where Hubbard Cutoff Road and 99E come together, about across the railroad track, about 600 feet. Can't remember the name of it sure right now. Charlotte Country Estates or something like that. And they have a treatment plant. And all of them have been there since the early 1970s. And they're all working. So there's three examples, but there's never been any follow-up on it. I think it would work in any part of the state. The other thing that I think there needs to be, and I probably get shot for this, a little reorganization of the chain of command. Not all from the top down, but allow the counties, they got some smart men in their county planning departments, allow them to make a little discretion on what can or can't be done with local stuff. I'm not saying throw the whole thing out and start over. I'm saying let's be realistic about it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. Rebecca Boyle.
Senator Atkinson and committee members, I might be a little bit off topic. I was told I could come and speak today about Measure 37 and my concerns about it.
Why don't you want to let us get through all this, or on the secondary lands debate? Or?
Well, it might have to do with secondary lands, actually.
Okay.
So I do have some written. My written material will not specifically say secondary lands, but my concerns do in part relate to them.
Okay.
I am not with any group. I'm just a small farmer that purchased my land in 1999. And I am in the area that, I think it was Mr. Weeks that just spoke before me, the exact area that he referred to, which he considers an area that you cannot build a house in. Hasn't seen a house go up. Well, I'm currently building one in that area, so I can tell you that there are houses going in. And the other point I wanted to make is that the land that he is talking about that has no value as farmland, the piece that I'm on is considered number one EFU land. But I will gather that when it was originally farmed, when the owner before us owned it, it was not EFU 1. It was a rocky mess that he cleared himself over the years and put all the rocks at the back of our field. There's 3 acres of them there now. My concern is the impact on our water resources with this development. And the example that I will give, I won't read this to you because I just handed it out, but I will give you the example of my neighbor who has informed us that he's going to be developing one of his 20-acre parcels. He has two of them. One of his parcels is what would be considered a secondary land. It's a farm forest land. I believe that's the one he wants to develop first. The other one sits directly next to mine, and it is, like mine, EFU with number one soils. If he develops his land to the extent that he can, it's RR1, so his 20-acre farm parcel could have 20 homes on it. The concern is, I'm just going to use mine, my home as an example. We just had to drill our second well. It's 8 gallons a minute. I don't water my lawn. I didn't even have a garden this year because I'm concerned about the water supply. The neighbor next to me on the other side has 7 gallons a minute, and the neighbor next to her just drilled twice to get 5 gallons a minute. And so if this land is developed to the extent that it can be, then I'm very concerned about the amount of water available. And there are no rules preventing this neighbor from drilling 20 wells as long as each of them does not use more than 15,000 gallons a day. So I don't see any protection for people like myself with regard to water supply if my water well is literally drained dry by people developing on EFU1 or secondary lands, which I am surrounded by those. One, the backside of my property, there's 200 acres that could get developed that is farm forest that would be considered a secondary land. On the other side of the road for me is all EFU number one lands with elderly people who have owned their land from the 1960s. All my neighbors adjoining my property, surrounding me, are eligible to develop their home, their lands, to the fullest extent. It would be RR1, so I could conceivably see 200 houses just from my house, maybe 400 within a mile of my house. And I frankly don't think there is the water to support those houses, and yet there is no restriction whatsoever for drilling and using the water till it's gone. And I don't think a lot of people developing these lands have concern about what is going to happen. I know for a fact that there was a individual who developed a 300-unit, I don't know if it was condos or apartments or what it was, but there was insufficient water, and by the time it was determined it was insufficient water, he was long gone. I've also been told by the Water Bureau that it is up to the individual whose well is impacted to show that it was that they were damaged and that their well was impacted negatively. So that would require me to have quarterly, whatever, monitoring of my well starting now. And then even in that situation, it's very difficult to prove that you've been negatively impacted because of the water usage of your neighbors. Maybe it's environmental. I don't, you know, it'd be a difficult situation to prove. So that's my concern, and it might be a little bit off topic. I apologize, but...
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead. Yeah.
Actually, I don't think it is off topic. All of these are interrelated. Every land use usage affects another one. So all of them belong, and I appreciate your comments, and I appreciate you coming this afternoon.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just to echo, you're not, that's, you're right on topic.
Okay.
My point is that what you're facing in the Willamette Valley and the rules that apply, in fact, I think it was spoken to, even leaving, one suggestion that's been brought to the committee is leaving soil classification as is in the Willamette Valley. I think, you know, I cannot speak, but I believe it works pretty well in the Willamette Valley, maybe not water protections, but my point is that the secondary land debate doesn't necessarily work everywhere else. Even if you divide the state in half, east and west, that still doesn't address from Rose, in my mind, from Douglas County south, because we're really different than eastern, and we're certainly not the valley. But mm-hmm. I think you make a very valid point with water. You know, I was curious, how deep is your second drill?
It's just almost 200 feet.
Yeah, that's just by reference, for what it's worth. I know someone at home has just dug their third at 900 feet.
Right.
It's just crazy. I mean, it's different. I want to thank you for coming, though.
Thank you.
I want to thank you for being a citizen and for enduring an hour and a half of this and for coming. And that's why that's very important, and I'm glad that you came.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sorry I missed it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just wanted to comment, and I'm not addressing this to Rebecca at all, but as I listened to Rebecca and before her, Mr. Weeks, the one difference between their sets of comments, Mr. Weeks, you made the comments that, you know, you'd been doing this 50, 60 years.
the difference between then and now is I was born in that world 50, 60 years ago on a planet of 2 billion people, and we now have 6. And when you begin to apply it to Rebecca, you begin to wonder how many of those wells we can keep punching in a finite amount of water. You know, it's a real tough situation.
Thanks, Senator Shields. Kerry McLaren?
Chair Ringo, members of the committee, my name is Kerry McLaren, staff attorney for 1000 Friends of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I, too, did provide some sort of bit of, I guess, background and history in terms of where I think the secondary lands debate has been. Thankfully, much of it actually occurred before I started working in the arena of land use. So I can't perhaps tell you the personal ins and outs, but my testimony today will attempt to address three major issues with respect to the designation of secondary lands. One, that past secondary lands proposals have included productive farm and forest lands, and I include that as history because as we go forward, I would suggest that should any proposal arise, it should not include productive farm and forest lands. Two, the concept of secondary lands, as you've heard today, has been considered and has been rejected by past legislatures. And instead, Oregon has rolled some of those concepts in and chosen an approach to farm and forest land protection that reflects regional differences as well as differences in land quality. And there are different definitions, as has been discussed today, with respect to the Willamette Valley, coastal high-value soils, eastern and western Oregon, in terms of designation of agricultural lands. Third, that there has been no demonstration of the need to develop secondary lands policy or an explanation of the purpose to which these lands would be put. At present, Oregon has roughly 890,000 acres of land zoned for rural development, most of which is in rural residential development, more land than what is currently inside of our urban growth boundaries. I did attempt to do some research for the committee and was unable to find some numbers as to how much of that has been built out, but past surveys indicated that we certainly had not exhausted that supply of land.
Carrie, may I ask a question? Mm-hmm. I've heard complaints that some of the land is just it's labeled wrong. It's classified wrong. How does that play in?
Chair Ringo, members of the committee, the way in which Mr. Honeycutt walked you through the definition of agricultural lands, and under Oregon's land use policies, land that does not meet that designation, I can go into, and it's currently happening in Douglas County and in various areas of the state today, if I'm an owner of land and I do not believe that my land meets the definition of agricultural land, simply doesn't qualify as that land, I can go in and make an application to my county to redesignate and rezone my land for non-resource lands.
And who in the county has the authority to do that?
It is. It usually follows the somewhat typical what is referred to as a post-acknowledgement plan amendment. So it does go through a planning decision. In most cases would be heard by not a decision that the planning director could make, but rather one that would be made of the planning commission, and then either a recommendation or a decision forwarded on to the county commissioners for their determination.
So let's say that you've got some corner of Union County that is sage and lava and the type of land Mr. Honeycutt was disparaging, but is labeled as ag land. That landowner could get that changed? Just through the local county process?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, going through a non-resource zoning process, they could. Now, I would like to actually specifically respond to some of those lands. When we look at Oregon agriculture and we look at the different crops that are grown in the state, that land in between Burns and Bend is actually essentially the home of what is now Oregon Country Beef, a large growing cooperative of family farms who are having an increasing share of the cattle and calves market. And indeed, if one were to add together the gross farm sales of cattle and calves and hay, it would be Oregon's number one product. These are not, cows are not grown on the same soil as we grow our carrots. And so I would just suggest to this committee that as we look at what really are productive agricultural soils, that we need to look at what are the crops that are grown in the state of Oregon, what types of circumstances do those crops, products, and commodities demand? And I mean, we see cattle ranchers definitely wanting to lease land from the Bureau of Land Management. That's not our most irrigated cropland, and yet that's very sought after as part of the cattle operation. So I think we, you know,
have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. This process that the landowner would go through, and the Planning and County Commission, what happens then if a neighbor or someone else doesn't like the fact that it gets rezoned? What do they do then?
Chair Ringo, Senator Beyer, it is does go through our typical land use process, which provides for notice to neighbors and an opportunity for citizens and neighboring property owners to appear, offer their own evidence into the record as to whether or not they think that land constitutes agricultural land under the definition of Goal 3. A decision by the Board of Commissioners would be a final land use decision appealable to the Land Use Board of Appeals. So it is consistent in nature with the other land use processes that one goes through for applications.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, then, so it goes to LUBA. LUBA remands it back to the county or does something with it, goes back and forth 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, how many years before a decision like this could be finalized? And then also, I'd like to know how many of these cases has Thousand Friends contested and on appeal?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I'll answer the last question first. I do not know of all of the non-resource land applications that have been filed and processed in this state. I can give you a figure in terms of the number of acreages. Therefore, I can't provide you with an accurate count of what percentage perhaps 1,000 Friends has been involved in. I will tell you that the rezoning of non-resource lands is of concern, and 1,000 Friends does participate where we feel as though the land that is being redesignated or is being applied to be redesignated is indeed agricultural land that should be protected under Goal 3. We do provide testimony on that, and we certainly have appealed or assisted in appeals of those land use decisions. Currently, right now, if I look at my notes, there are about 86,000 acres that have been designated as non-resource. And as I say, I've seen a number of applications, particularly probably in Douglas County, Josephine County, Klamath County, Crook County are areas where I have seen the most number of applications or largest acreages being sought for redesignation to non-resource zoning.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to pick that out because of what sounded like a fairly simple process when it's described as go to the county commission or go to the county planner and then just file as a farmer who should know best. In reality, it gets contested, brought before LUBA, brought back to the county, looked at again, if it makes sense, go back to LUBA, Court of Appeals, and we're talking about years and thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars to do this. It's not a simple process.
Yeah, I guess just one comment. I'd kind of appreciate more details on that to know whether, I mean, how easy the process is, because I don't know. I mean, I believe what you're saying, but I also wonder whether there are times when it works smoothly and it's a system that works.
And yes, there are some that work smoothly. I would agree with that. But the marginal ones don't.
Yeah, okay. Just to keep us on schedule here, I want to go about another 3 minutes, and then we've got 5 minutes with Harlan and 5 minutes with Art, and that's, I think, what our schedule is. So I think that's okay with the committee.
Certainly, Chair Ringo, members of the committee. I'll point you, I'm sort of looking at page 2 of my testimony, and I'm of course just going to summarize it. I'll point you to the attachments that I gave you in your testimony. One, I think, because particularly at this time of the day, looking at a picture is nicer than looking at small text. This provides you with some pictorial analysis of what many of past secondary lands proposals have sought to designate as secondary lands or areas that people were concerned that might not be included and protected. One of them, of course, you see, and that is an obvious example frequently in this discussion, are the vineyard lands in the Red Hills of Dundee and in southern Oregon predominantly, but certainly growing in Douglas County and growing in Hood River and the areas of the Gorge as well. Today there are more than 400 vineyards in Oregon with more than 13,400 acres planted. The total economic impact to the state of Oregon from the wine industry is nearly $1 billion. I've attached for you also in yellow off of the state of Oregon's websites some of the discussions about some of the media information about branding Oregon, talking about Oregon's wine industry, talking about Oregon's pear industry, and talking about Oregon's dairy industry, all frequently grown on lands that might not fit into a classification of Class 1 and Class 2. A second, and I'm not a soil science expert, and I would be happy to provide additional information for the committee, but again, somewhat of a pictorial analysis on the back of that secondary landscapes is a soil survey from the Linn County area, and what I think it does a good job of simply depicting is how soils don't come in nice large blocks. We really have very fingered and interrelated soils, and so to try to separate out at times a Class 4 soil from a Class 2 soil and say let's have a new city on the Class 4 is really going to have some significant impact on Class 2 soils, and we don't have these sort of neat boundaries that we might think or even maybe in some cases might even desire. Mr. Eber and others have discussed how the legislation in 1993, House Bill 3661, really pulled in some components of a secondary lands concept, if you will, authorizing a increased level of development, particularly on lands that were deemed less productive. And I have referenced the statutory provisions for all of those authorizations. In closing, I would note again the amount of land we currently have available for rural residential use, and the fact that actually within our process as well, every year counties are rezoning agricultural and forest use to rural development. Since 1994, approximately 8,300 acres of farm and forest zone lands have been rezoned for rural development, 85% of which was to rural residential development. My last comment will be with respect to the urban growth boundaries, and I certainly share the concerns of Senator Atkinson that in many cases our cities are growing onto some of our most productive farmland. That is indeed an issue, and currently in Oregon law, the way in which we have dealt with that is to rank and to say that a city must expand first onto the least productive lands, leaving the most productive lands first. So we do have in state policy some direction saying that we are going to protect our most valuable or most highly productive agricultural lands first. I would be happy to work with him and other members of this committee strengthening the provisions to protect farmlands that are outside of our urban growth boundaries, but am somewhat disheartened that I expect that there will actually be bills in this legislative session that would seek only to weaken those standards that we already have for protecting farmlands that are adjacent to urban growth boundaries. With that, I will close my testimony and would be happy to answer any additional questions the committee may have.
Thank you very much.
Harlan?
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you, Chair Ringel, members of the committee. Good afternoon. Again, for the record, I am Harlan Levy, Senior Staff Attorney with the Oregon Association of Realtors. We see the passage of Measure 37 as an opportunity for the legislature to finally deal with the issue of secondary lands. You have 16 million acres in the state of Oregon zoned for exclusive farm use. You have 8 million zoned for forest use. At the same time, you only have 890,000 acres zoned as exception land and only 86,000 acres zoned as non-resource. That is 4% of the private property, private land base outside of urban growth boundaries.
Harlan, do you have written testimony?
I don't have any written testimony.
Okay.
Hope you get that to us in writing, because that's good stuff.
Chair Ringo, Senator Shields, these numbers are reflected in the testimony that Mr. Eber submitted to you earlier today. I'm just taking his numbers. The problem with this, with these 24 million acres, is there really is no planning going on. We call our system an Oregon statewide system of land use planning, but in fact it's the absence of planning on resource lands. What we have is a situation where we designate these lands as resource lands, and then there's a list of approved uses in statute that you can use on these lands, and then we take exceptions from those uses, and again, those exceptions are very hard to come by. But there isn't really any planning going on out there. It's merely a resource zone designation by counties that was done many years ago, and there isn't any planning going on. And this has resulted in some significant economic problems for much of the state of Oregon. You have had double-digit unemployment in much of rural Oregon for many years. I mean, well before the population centers of the state went into recession, you had double-digit unemployment in counties such as Hood River County, such as Malheur County, such as Baker County, such as Curry County, going back beginning in the 1980s.
Clackamas County.
Double-digit unemployment. In some of these counties, you have 50% of the children qualifying for free lunches because the economic base is not there. It's been devastated by this absence of planning. You have high unemployment. You have high alcoholism rates. You have all the social ills that go along with people that just are not able to make a living.
Harlan, I'm waiting for the answer.
I'm getting there, Senator.
Okay.
So we would submit to you that now is the opportunity. Now is the opportunity with the passage of Measure 37 for this legislature to actually pass some planning legislation to allow counties to actually plan for economic development on these lands. Return some of the local control to your county commissioners. Give them the opportunity to actually designate secondary lands for economic development. Allow them to create, you know, economic development uses on this property to enhance property tax revenues for them, to enhance income tax revenue for the state as a whole. Now is your opportunity, and we would submit that we think that this legislature has a golden opportunity with the passage of 37 and the need to avoid some of these compensation claims to actually loosen up the system just enough by providing this flexibility to local governments, to county commissioners, to actually go out and plan this land, to do that which we believe Senate Bill 100 was actually created to do over 30 years ago. With that, I will conclude my testimony and be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Got a bill drafted?
Chair Ringo, we do not have a bill drafted on secondary lands, but I would be happy to work with you or anybody else on this committee to do that.
Have there been such bills drafted in past sessions?
Senator Ringo, we had a bill last session that only spoke to exception lands. Again, this 4% of the rural land base that I'm talking about that would have done just this. That bill did pass the House of Representatives but did not get through the Senate last time. If you wanted to talk about
it. I'm sorry, go ahead.
We'd be happy to talk about bringing that bill back. But again, that was a very limited of scope and only dealt with rural exception at land. So only this 890,000 acres that we're talking about here.
Do you have a concept paper or materials relating to the bill from last session that you could provide?
Senator Ringo, I'd be happy to go back and provide that to this committee. Sure.
Thank you. Committee? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Schlack, we kept you to last time. Of course, you are last on the list.
Yes.
Sorry about that.
That's the way it goes.
Sorry about that.
That's all right. Last is good sometimes, Mr. Chair.
You get to refute everybody else.
I'm afraid I probably won't.
Okay.
Chair Ringo, members of the committee, my name's Art Schlack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And with regard to secondary lands, marginal lands, small-scale resource lands, all of these little names we've tried to give to lands that there has been discussion about, that these are truly not agriculture and forest lands. Let me just share with you the fact that counties really would not like the opportunity to again and we've tried to do this many times, identify marginal lands, secondary lands, or whatever at this point. What we would like is the opportunity to reevaluate the agriculture and forest lands that have been designated in our comprehensive plans based on the information that we have today, which is much more specific than what we had in the 1970s and the early 1980s, and to redesignate the lands that should be conserved for agriculture and forest land, and to remove those lands that are currently designated agricultural and forest land and put them into other classifications that would allow the development of those lands based on the carrying capacity and the services that are available in the area. You've heard the concern about water. Water certainly is a concern. It is a growing concern. So the density of a rural residential area or an area that is would develop for non-resource activities needs to at least have some consideration to the carrying capacity of that area, given groundwater, given subsurface sewage disposal, maybe even given transportation kinds of considerations. But I would submit to you that another exercise to try and define or map or identify secondary lands will be fraught with lots of problems and issues and be very expensive. What we need is a comprehensive legislative process that gives, with counties having some flexibility, to truly go through and remap those lands. You've heard about 80,000 acres of non-resource land. You've heard about other things. We know, and the Department of Land Conservation and Development will admit, there are lands that are in an EFU or an exclusive forest zone that probably shouldn't be. Because when we did that exercise back in the 70s and 80s, it was a very broad brush approach, and there were lands that were swept into those classifications because they were not physically developed and committed to non-farm, non-forest uses. But they were, they're not the lands that, you know, we've talked about so much about being conserved for agriculture and forest uses. And that's what we really need. Now, whether that process comes soon with the legislature providing the guidance and probably some financing to undertake that, or whether it's part of the 30-year review, I'm not sure at this point. But I would just suggest to you that secondary lands and that exercise, which we've gone down that path three times that I know of in the last 15 years to no avail, probably is not going to get us very far again. And I think it would be better to re-examine in a legislative process on a county-by-county basis and then remove those lands from an exclusive farm and forest and put them in a classification that better fits those for the use for the benefit of the county as well as the property owners. And in doing so, it will address some of the Measure 37 issues that, you know, from those lands being in an exclusive farm or forest zone, because in all probability, all likelihood, those lands would allow a house as a matter of right, assuming that they can meet all the other tests.
Could you just articulate for me what process you don't want to go through again? I need to understand that better.
Mr. Chair, we've had some general direction to counties to go out and remap and identify secondary lands. And it has been extremely excruciating, taken a lot of time and money, and at the end of the day, we've not been able to accomplish that. It happened it's a couple of times in the 80s, and it's happened in the 90s. We'd also note that the legislature previously, and I'm not suggesting that maybe the times have changed, have really shied away from secondary lands. I don't think that really the question is secondary lands. It's a question of what lands ought to be in an exclusive farm and forest zone and what lands ought to be in a, if you want to call it an exclusive or primary forest area. The other lands should be taken something out. I don't think it's anything about secondary. It's the fact that they're not those primary lands that that are in the best interest of the state to provide tax benefits because they're an exclusive farm or forest zone that everybody, you know, contributes to, and that the land should be conserved long-term for agriculture and forest uses.
What do you suggest that this committee do in terms of moving forward on the issue?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would suggest that we look at what it would take to give counties the flexibility and what kind of funding would be necessary to truly take a to re-examine the farm and forest lands in a legislative process, and for the counties then to identify those lands that should be removed. I'm not sure at this point that would require changes to the definition of agriculture and forest, because I've worked with some of those, and I have experienced identifying lands that if I had my druthers, I wouldn't have been in those classifications.
So I'm not sure what you want this committee to do.
Find money.
Provide direction, Mr. Chair, and you know, in terms of providing direction to undertake the effort, and as Senator Breyer said, it's going to take some money. It's going to take funding, whether it's secondary lands or whether it's okay. what I'm speaking to. But I think my process at the end of the day gets us to a better place, because we don't have all of these clouds about what's secondary and what's primary and what's others. You draw a clear distinction, which I think it benefits everyone.
Thank you very much. Committee?
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
We're out at 5. That closes the hearing.